Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our show this evening will be about the kosher food and wine experience. We tasted on Monday. We spoke to a number of winemakers, and in some cases, you might even hear similar questions that I asked the different guests. And the reason is very simple. I am trying to find out what makes these people tick, because I firmly believe that to make a good wine takes a dedicated, passionate individual with true artistry of the soul. And you will hear some stories, some unusual stories, how winemaking has brought these people to a certain path in their lives they never expected. My first guest is Jay Buxbaum, the Vice President of Royal Wine Corporation.
What makes this year different from other years, aside from the fact that there may be more restaurants, more wines, but what is so special about this year?
I think the biggest change was the component of dividing the press and trade from the consumers. It's allowed and this you're going to see hopefully as a result of this, a lot more stories and a lot more press about the event and more importantly about the wines at the event. Because now the trade and the press can take more time without fighting through the tons of people trying to get to the table at the same time as they are, so they can have a little bit more time to speak to the winemaker, to speak to the vineyard owner, to speak to the chateau representative to talk more about the wine. So I think that's the biggest thing. The second biggest thing is that for the first time in history, we've established something called the Israel Wine Producers Association. They are here with us. And for the first time, that means that all the Israeli wineries here today have come together in a concerted effort to promote Israel as a new wine-growing region. And as a result, you're going to see a lot of new Israeli wines here today and a lot of press and focus on how great Israel is making their wines these days.
I remember in earlier years there was a huge French contingent. Do we still have that?
We still have the huge French contingent. About 3 years ago, the French government decided to be involved and be a sponsor of the event because of the wonderful wines of France and because of their recognition of how important the kosher and the rising palate of the kosher consumer is to better wines, especially French wines. They are not sponsoring it this year, but we have at least as many new wines from France as we had in the past, albeit not in its own pavilion, but certainly there, wonderfully to taste. For example, we have a new sparkling wine, actually not a sparkling wine, a true champagne called Drapier that's ready to be tasted this year, with the new vintages of Rothschild that will be ready to be tasted this year. And in fact, the Rothschild consulting winemaker is here as well, Mr. Pierre Medovnik. So, if for those of you who are watching this, because this is pre-taped, make sure you get your tickets in early next year. We have been sold out already for over 10 days. And we expect that even if we expanded another 500 tickets next year, we expect to be sold out again. And people who are going to get their emails early in are going to be the ones to get the first tickets for next year.
Well, Royal is basically a winemaker and wine importer. Even if you have a restaurant in California, Tierra Sur, and so on, and I hear great things about it, I guess I'll have no choice but to go and visit it. But how did you come up with the idea of having a food and wine show?
For many, many years, there were many, many smaller food and wine shows, or I should say wine tastings, for the kosher consumer. They were spread throughout New York, Manhattan, New Jersey, etc. And several years ago, some of the retailers actually came to us and asked us, is there any place we can taste all the wines at once? Instead of having a smattering of wines in Upper Manhattan or, another smattering of wines in Brooklyn and bring in one winemaker, we thought it would be a great opportunity to bring them all together for one place. Here today you have probably 40 winery representatives, an amazing amount of intellectual wine knowledge and just plain old wine lore together in one place to share with the consumer. So, we spend the lion's share of our budget on tastings throughout the country. We thought we'd up that a little bit. We'd up our game a little bit by spending an enormous amount of money on trying to put together this great event so that people can taste them all in one place. And we kind of coordinate it so that it's before Purim and Passover, for Purim and Pesach, and that's how the idea came about.
Any new wines that are being introduced, in short?
In short, Flam is going to be introduced, brand new winery Kosher. It's been in business for over 10 years, but for the first time, the Kosher wines are being made and now introduced there. Moscato Rosé and White Moscato Sparkling are going to be introduced. Tulip is going to be introduced. A host of wines from a myriad of other companies, including Bin from Binyamina, and the first time ever, Oregon Pinot Noir, and Meritage from Pacifica. A whole host of wines, several new wines from France, as I mentioned before, new vintages, certainly. Last year we had a barrel sample of something called Amarello from Alexander. Now we actually have the real product that's being tasted here today, and some new vineyard designated wines from Psagot and Shiloh and a host of other wineries. So that's just a short list, and there's many, many more.
Okay, thank you very much, Jay. As always, it is a pleasure having you on our program. As a matter of fact, I constantly refer to you as the Walking Wine Encyclopedia. I constantly consult to it.
Thank you very much.
For our next guests, we will be talking to the two winemakers from Binyamina. First one is Sason Ben-Aaron and Asaf Paz. Good evening, gentlemen. Good evening, Sason.
Good evening.
Good evening, Asaf.
Good evening.
We'd like to hear a little bit about Binyamina, how it came to be. Let's face it, at one point, the only winery outside of Israel that we heard from Israel was Carmel. In fact, if you ask the average American, is there any wineries in Israel? Of course, Carmel. Anybody else? No, wouldn't know. All of a sudden, Binyamina became quite well known, specifically with The Cave and other such wines. The Cave, I always tell everybody, is my favorite wine. I'd like to hear a little bit about how Binyamina came to its present position, and tell us what are some of the new selections that you're coming up with.
Okay, right now Binyamina is not so small winery in Israel. We are producing about 2.5 million bottles every year. The point of Binyamina right now is very interesting because we are going to increase capacity mainly for the high quality wines, and this is the result of the new plantation that we've done in the last 3 years, and we are going to do it better and better because we invest a lot of money in the vineyard, a lot of effort. We have agronomists that work in full time job in the vineyard to guide all the farmer over there, and on this issue, we are going to have better and better and much more regarding quantity of high quality wines in the future.
Sal?
Yes, as Sasson said, we are in the middle or almost in the end of an ongoing revolution, not less than that, of quality, eventually also of quantity, but first and foremost of quality. I think the whole Israeli wine industry is experiencing a huge renaissance, and it's very interesting to taste today Israeli wine, especially compared to 15 or 20 years ago. There is a great selection and very big enthusiast in the winemaking area. Sason and I work together in Binyamina to represent properly each wine growing region of Israel, but also answer the demands of the market. It's very nice and romantic to produce a wine, but if you're not selling it, nothing is worth it, because you need to keep the machine going. But we try to really give the proper respect for each wine growing region. We believe that almost in all of the wine growing region you can find average parcel, medium quality parcel, and sometimes high or premium even parcels, with the right selection of varieties, the right agro-technology, and the right work in the winery. Binyamina now employs a full-time job agronomist that help us control on everything that's going in the vineyard from the moment we choose the parcel to plant over there, and the decision what to plant, how to plant it, and so on, and until the time of harvest when we harvest the grapes, and back and forth from that every year.
How long has Beniamina been around, and how did it evolve to the present point? And the reason I'm asking is, there was a time in America and in Uruguay, where I grew up in Latin America, where if you ask what is kosher wine, they would tell you that's any wine you just throw out half the bottle, fill it up with sugar, and now it's a kosher wine. Well, we've come a long, long way since then, but how did it happen?
Beniamina Winery established in 1952, and since those time there was a lot of changes regarding the wine industry in Israel, of course in Beniamina. Regarding kosher wine or non-kosher wine, of course we are producing kosher wine for the Israeli market and also for export. Well, right now the kosher wine are really high quality wines because of the technology, and not all of the wine are cooked wine that people are looking for, maybe something for event or so for a restaurant, so on. But we, the people, the winemakers from Beniamina, can tell you that our wine go to a lot of competition around the world, and they are tasting and blind tasting. No one knows if it's kosher or non-kosher, and we can get a really high recommendation and a medal. So there is no problem if the wine is kosher or non-kosher. The idea is to test the wine and to know that this is the wine that's produced in Israel and the Holy Land, that grow in the source of wine production around the world, and this is the idea.
Well, just to give an example, the first time I had ever read about Amara, the cave, the accompanying comment was, this is a superb world-class wine that just happens to be kosher.
I think this is the right phrasing of that.
The idea is not you are judging the wine in the glass, and it's not important what is on the label. The joy is during tasting and drinking the wine. You can get a lot of story around, but the pleasant is in your sense.
I think it's also important to say about Beniamina, if we summarize what happened to Beniamina from the time that we established, well, not we, but since the time that the winery was established up until today, it's very easy to refer it to it as like we passed three generations. The first generation was when the winery was established. Unfortunately, when it was established those days, it was very hard to purchase grapes, so the winery had to purchase from other her competitors, and to produce only sweet, as you said, those sweet kosher wines that everybody remember for the worst for us. And the second generation was in the 90s, when the man that established the winery wasn't around anymore, and the winery was purchased by two ex-Israelis that actually work in United States in LA. They are film producers, and they were very enthusiastic and Zionist to invest in a Hebrew business, in a business that operates in Israel, and they bought the winery. And the first thing that they change is the name from Elias, which was the name of the winery before, that was upon the name of...
Elias had a very bad reputation, let's face it.
And they decided to change it, and they called the name of the winery upon the place it is, like in the French tradition, like in other places. We are in Beniamina, it's a very beautiful name, let's change the name to Beniamina. And they did a lot to take out bad equipment and to take out bad vineyards and to put better and better vineyards. The third generation and the last step that we made was, I think it's one of the major and giant steps that we made. It's when the winery was purchased from those two formal investors by a retail food chain in Israel. Everybody thought that the winery will decrease its quality because they related it to food chain, which doesn't seem very romantic, but actually the opposite happened. The owners of this food chain are very serious businessmen, and they know that quality is first, and what they did and what they expected from us is to upgrade the level of the total production, and they help us bring the state-of-the-art machinery and equipment to the winery. If you're going today to the winery, people that visit Binyamina, they ask us if it's the same winery, if it's the same place, because they cannot believe the upgrade that goes in the equipment. Also in the vineyard, we purchased better and better fruit because we planted much more vineyards in the right places with the right varieties and work with the right farmers. And fruit that wasn't good enough for us, we're selling to other wineries because we don't want to put it in our wine. So we upgraded in a very dramatic way the quality of grapes that's going into the winery. And if you put together this with the increase of quality of equipment and the know-how that we are acquiring each and every year, plus our formal education, for example, Sasson and I just finished a professional tour in the wineries of Northern California. We've been 10 days, we spent 10 days with the best farmers from Opus One and Rod Estate in Napa Valley to the most remote little producers in Mendocino County and Dry Creek and places that are really small and very familial, to see all those wine methods that could be relevant for us, that could give us new ideas how to improve and bring you better wines in a better price, actually.
Just out of curiosity, those two Israeli movie producers you mentioned, would one of them have been Mr. Globus?
Ah, no. not him.
Not from Canon Films?
No, not from Canon Films.
Okay. What was the name, by the way, since I used to work with most of them?
Avi Lerner and Danny Wimbort. It's a film production company called New Image. And they were very good to Binyamina, but we moved on.
I thought it was Mr. Globus. I used to do still photography for him in the days when there used to be photographs outside the movie houses.
Wow.
So all the productions, all the stills were made by me for Herzliya movie productions.
Wow.
Anyway.
That's a nice detail to know about.
Yeah, well, it's a long way since.
It's a small world.
Another life. What are some of the new wines? What are some of the wines that you truly recommend if you were to take a wine from the winery to your home today? What would you take?
You know, I get this question all the time. Before I became a winemaker, I was a pastry chef, and always they ask me, what is the dessert that you like the best? And I told them it's like asking a child which one do you like more, mother or father, or to ask the parents which child they like more. It's very hard. I don't know if it's possible to answer. But I think it's more than that. When people ask me, which wine should I take? I'm going to eat a beef stew. I told them it's not really interesting me what you're going to eat. It's more interesting for me, who are you going to eat it with? Because the first thing you need to adjust the wine is to the people that drink it. You don't take the Me'ara. I don't take the Me'ara to a family dinner when I know that I have a lot of aunts that don't drink wine and they want something sweet and, you know, bubbly. But for them, I will bring the Muscato that we produce in the Teva label or in the Bean label, which is so nice and sweet for summer days, and everybody is falling in love with this wine, and vice versa. So I think the first thing that you need to know, who is going to drink the wine. If it's a family dinner in Paz family, we drink a lot, but we also like to drink good. My mother is a Cabernet person. My father likes just about everything. And my sister and brother really like white wines and their families as well. But if we have a very special occasion that really requires something unique, I either take the Cave or the Old Vine Cave, which is extremely rare wine and also a little bit expensive, but it's worth the price, or I take one of the chosen wines. We have in the chosen series the Sapphire, which is more approachable and more easy to drink because it's containing Shiraz, almost 45% Shiraz, and this gives him a lot of a very palatable approach and very round character that makes him a very wine that's very easy to like. Or I will take the Aquamarine, which is a full body Cabernet, classical. If I want something very unique, I will take the Diamond, which is a new blend that we make. It's a little bit more rare because the quantity, the production is very low. But I think the reserve level that we have today is one of the best choices. Because in the reserve level, all of the wines, the whites, and especially the reds, gives you an amazing quality with a very affordable price. I'm not sure about retail, don't kill me, but I think it's around the 20 plus, somewhere over there. But in this price, for those wines, you get tremendous fruit and quality, and we called it the classical level of Binyamina wines because we try to make it from the classical growing region for those grapes in Israel. For example, the Cabernet is coming from the High Galilee because it needs more fresh environment, and the Carignan, the old vine Carignan, which is a new release that I'm crazy about Carignan, so I did a lot of effort to do this wine in Binyamina. It's coming from the Low Galilee because Carignan required more sun and more dry weather and more heat, and also the Zinfandel in this level. And if you take, for example, the Anouk Chardonnay, which we look for a very mineral, citrusy, fresh and crispy wine, and we also close it with the screw cap to keep all this freshness inside, we take it from a premium vineyard in the high Judean mountains, very close to Jerusalem. You can see the Hadassah from this vineyard, and over there, very shallow soil, very rocky, very mineral, that gives everything we need for this wine. Another very interesting release in the reserve level is the late harvest cluster select Gewürztraminer. That very interesting story about this wine is that when we've been in Provine and we presented this wine, there was a group of Austrian winemakers that came and tasted this wine, and I was sure they're going to kill me. How do you produce sweet wine in Israel? But I was confident enough to give it to them because I know what I have in the bottle, and they came back half an hour later with every and each producer of wine bring his own late harvest to give us as a present, because they really admire this wine, and they told us that they really appreciate the effort because they know that we can produce very decent red wines in Israel, but they couldn't believe that we can produce a late harvest wine in Israel. Another thing that I want to say about our new release, it's a new label that we created. We call it BIN, B-I-N. So BIN in the wine world, it means a selected group of bottles or of barrels that were kept for a certain purpose in the winery, aside from all of the rest. Normally it was for a certain guy that wants them, or a restaurant, or a royalty, like a little bit like the reserve in Europe, in Spain or in Italy, but in Australia they call it BIN because they put it in BIN, all the bottles. But so you have Australian wineries that call their wines BIN one something and all of those numbers, and we call it BIN because also it's like a nickname for Binyamina, and the bottles have inside of them, the wine is actually made from wines that normally we take for the Yogev, which is a higher level of wine. But we make them in a more fruit-forward way. We give them less skin contact. We give them a fermentation in cooler temperature to keep the fruit content. And also we pick them a little bit early to get maybe less alcohol, but more fruity side and more wine that will be easy to drink in the early stage. And those wines are amazing wines with food. They're great food wines. The price is unbelievable. I just came back from the stand of Binyamina, and at least five people that tasted with me, all the people actually, they give this wine to five people, different people from wine shops and from restaurants, and they saw the price, they tasted the wine, they said, okay, we take it, because it matched all what they wanted. They look for wine that was not very expensive, that could give them a very good value for money, and the BIN level, which now has Cabernet, Merlot, Chardonnay without oak, and soon there will be a Moscato BIN. I don't think if it's still in the market yet, if it's yet in the market or not, but a Moscato BIN that will answer the demand for sweeter wine are great choice.
You mentioned before the Shiraz grape. For the benefit of my listeners, Shiraz and Syrah are very similar, if not the same grape. What exactly is the difference? Why the difference in names?
Shiraz and Syrah are identically, are genetically identical, okay? It's like taking if we make a very simple caricature of the things, it will like taking a gray cat and a red, orange cat. We call it Gingy in Hebrew, a red hair cat. They are both cats. They are similarly, identically from the genetic point of view, but they look different. So the in vines, in grapevines, we can have the same variety that acts a little bit different. For example, we can have in a Cabernet, we have a clone, we call it clone. A clone that gives more yield, bigger berries, or a clone that gives smaller yield and smaller berries. That's more concentrate and better for premium wine making, but less better for everyday wine if you want to make a soft and easy to drink Cabernet. It's the same with Shiraz and Syrah. But also more than that, there are a lot of legends about the Shiraz coming from the town of Shiraz in Persia, in Iran of today. And the French did a research that shows that the Shiraz and Syrah of today are coming from a crossing between two native French varieties, or varieties that were in the Alps and Upper Rhone Valley. And it's a very long discussion, but to make a long story short, the varieties are identical. We tend to call, I think it's better to refer the wine according to the style of winemaking, the time of picking the grapes, because for me, a Syrah is a more elegant, fresh wine, let's call it a cold character wine, with a little bit less alcohol, with a little bit better acidity, which is more complex and more multi-layered, versus the Shiraz, that is very a fruit bomb, high maturity, big, jammy, sweet fruit that is very easy to like, that is very easy to make. People like this wine, like everybody likes Malbec today, quite similar to that one. So you can, sometimes we can take the clone that we call in Israel, Syrah, and to make something very Shiraz-like out of it, and vice versa. So this is, I think, two styles of vinification, if you ask me. The Shiraz is more bold and more mature and more the higher maturity and more sweet and fruity. And the Syrah is more elegant and more restrained and more complex. So every wine and his drinker.
Thank you very, very much, Asaf. As usual, it's a pleasure. But first, let's have a little bit of that wine. And my next guest is Dr. Moises Cohen from the LV Winery in Spain. As a South American, anything from Spain, anything that speaks Spanish, and yes, this wine does speak Spanish. As you drink it, you understand what I mean. It's very close to my heart. Therefore, it happens to be special pleasure to interview Dr. Cohen, especially when you hear the fascinating story of the LV Winery. Good evening, Dr. Cohen.
Good evening.
Let's start with the history of the winery.
Okay, so we are 25 years in the wine making, wine business. Our history from my side, from my wife's side, I will say that I'm an agronomist. I study in Israel in the Technion, so I have a PhD in agriculture engineering. And I arrived to Spain by chance, but as a Sephardic, I have the sensation that I have come back again to my roots. So I was born in Morocco, I moved to France, Switzerland, Israel, and again to Sephardic, to Spain. So even if it's was not usual for Jewish families in all over the world, but also in Morocco, to have land, to buy land, to grow, we can say that at least 5-6 generation in my side and my wife's side, in Toulouse, in France, we were growers. And we still have some fields in north of Morocco, in Larache. And maybe from that reason that pushed me very young to move to Israel and to study one of the best places that can, I think everyone can study agriculture. I came to Spain as a researcher. I worked 15 years in research, and I started an international consultant company that we have in Spain and in South America, in Chile, based in Chile. We work in different countries. And I arrived 21 years ago in Spain when the development of the wine business started. Spain is like in France, fantastic genetical potential of grapes. And I started to work to be consultant of many companies. I started to be a wine lover. We started to make wine. And 10 years ago, we said with my wife, okay, so why we don't start our own company? LV Wine started 10 years ago. LV, we are in Catalonia, in Barcelona. LV in Catalan means the wine, but it's not true in that sense. The Catalan people are very happy because they say, okay, we have a Catalan name, but L come from Elohim. V, wine. As a researchers, we know that we try to make the best wine year by year, but there is general rules, we can call them like the weather and other things that are L, are above. So there is somebody who control if the year has to be well or not. As a human being, as a professionals, we try to make the best one we can year by year. That's why the concept of LV wines. And we worked 8 years. We developed in 8 different regions. We are talking only on kosher wines, only on kosher wineries. I think that we are the unique kosher winery in Europe. And obviously, and after 1492, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, we are the first Jewish family. So after 600 years, come again to Sepharad, again to agriculture, and again making wine. So for that reason, we have the sensation that more than a kosher issue, it's a heritage issue. And we said that all the wines should be kosher from the beginning. But as we wanted to make the best Spanish wines, we didn't wanted to work at the beginning with kosher importers, because we want our wine to be evaluated as normal wines. Nowadays, after 10 years, we can say that in Spain, our wines like L26, Herenza, Clomesora, Invita are in the top Spanish restaurants, which are the first restaurants in the world, like El Bui, say the Can Roca, Arzac. We are talking about 3-star Michelin restaurants. Our wines are there. They even don't know that the wines are kosher.
And then, I also saw on the Spanish Guia Peñin,
right,
that your wines are extremely highly rated between 92 and 97.
Exactly. And a good example is the Herenza from Rioja. Rioja is a big area like Bordeaux. And to be in Rioja, to make a wine and to be, let's say, at least rated, not well rated, rated, it's something important. But Herenza is not a simple crianza. It's the best crianza in Rioja, number one, with 94 and 97 points. Two following vintages. It was so important, let's say, for the Rioja and for the wine business in Spain, that even in the national TV, in TV Uno, Televisión Española, they make us a special interview on the best crianza. And they say it's a kosher wine. They don't understand what does it mean, kosher. But we can say that Herenza is the best crianza in Rioja, number one. The Invita, it's also a very nice history. Invita in Latin means in life, so in Hebrew, Lechaim. It's not by chance. It's made in a small area close to Barcelona. And in the antique Roman Empire, Barcelona was very important. Was called Barcino. And the wine that they were bringing from Spain to Rome was from that area called Aleia. That's why we make that wine called Invita. And in our very nice packaging, you will see an antique amphora, number one, so first century. And it's made, like all our wines, with local grapes. Invita is made with Panza Blanca, white stomach, called also Charello, and Sauvignon Blanc. A very nice history also. The thing are not done by chance. I think something happens with when you move and when you really trust on what you are doing. Herenza and Mati, the Rioja, are made in an old castle of the 11th century. When we started to make the wine there, why we selected that area? Because Rioja is divided in three. Rioja Alta is the best quality in Rioja. So we are in Rioja Alta, but not Alta, we are in the Super Alta. That means that after our vineyard is the last vineyard in Rioja Alta, after we have mountains. We are in the west side, west part of Rioja Alta, so we have an influence, an Atlantic influence, not even Mediterranean influence. That means that the wine is extremely elegant. That's why if we have to talk on the, to resume the Erenza in one word, Erenza is elegancy. Not by chance it was selected the best Crianza in Rioja. And the history of the castle is that when we arrived there, the winery is inside the rocks, so we use only natural temperature. It's absolutely beautiful. I invite you to visit. And with the winemaker, Javier Martinez, he told me, you know, you see that river who is just touching the castle? I say, yes. So crossing the river, we generations call that the Jewish Quarter. And I say, nice, I would like to visit the Jewish Quarter. We visit the Jewish Quarter, and there are a lot of ruins, which was very antique wineries that during 500-600 years, nobody touched. And when I visit one of them, just in front of our winery, I saw in the rocks, in the entrance of the old winery that is still remained, the exactly placement of the mezuzah, because it's placed in the right hand, one third, two third, exactly how it's described, as should be the mezuzah, and encrusted inside the rocks. So it was not done by chance. It means that we are making wine, Erenza Mati, after, again, 600 years, in a place that the Sephardic, before, were making kosher wines. So maybe it's not by chance that the Erenza, I think that we are good professionals. But it's a nice history, and that's why it's one of the reasons why all the LV1s are kosher, but as I say, as added value. That's why we want to see our wines in the regular section and in the kosher section. We try to make the best Spanish wine, and they happen to be kosher.
Now, you mentioned before that, yes, you happen to be great professionals, and based on what I tasted last evening, there is no doubt you are. However, between the name Erenza or Erencia,
all right,
and the fact that you happen to be where there were already Jewish vineyards, Jewish winemakers, I believe that it is not a question of a coincidence. Everything happened by design. And you are the company that actually gets to inherit all that beauty, all that tradition of the Spanish kosher winemaking.
That's why. When we launched the Erenza name, people told me, what does it mean, Erenza, with Z-E, Erencia, right? I said, no, Erenza in Ladino means heritage. That's why the name of our wines, Erenza, Clos Mezora, Mezora tradition, EL26, EL from LVL, Elohim 26, Yudke Vavke, 26. Because we think that we are doing something special. We want, first of all, the consumer to enjoy the wine. I am the first consumer who want to enjoy the wine. But wine and tradition and the Jewish tradition is something very special. I think so we are really happy and proud that we are doing something very good, and we feel that we are in the right moment doing the right things.
You absolutely are. Thank you very much. We truly enjoyed listening to you, but now I would like to test those wines.
Absolutely.
Do they come up to the level of what I tasted yesterday?
Okay, we do that. Very good.
And our next guest is Jürgen Wagner from Capçanes, Spanish, one of the top Spanish wineries. I'd like to ask Jürgen to tell us a little bit about how Capçanes became kosher. Why kosher? They were already famous as an unkosher winery. Why try their hand at something new? Why not continue with the thing that always worked?
I think the story at Capçanes, it's pretty bizarre. It's really strange. Because Capçanes in our area, we used to make wine for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Everything started 2,000 years ago with the Romans. Then later on, in the 13th century, the Catholic Church created the Priorat area, and they made winemaking in a much more efficient way. Unfortunately, in 1900, the little insect Phylloxera from one day to the other destroyed all the vineyards. So before
throughout Europe,
and in our area it was in 1905, 1908. So people really lost everything from one day to the other. And so in 1908, when only a small percentage of the farmers started to replant, exactly the same time when the industrialization process in Spain started, when Barcelona grew very fast and Valencia grew very fast, and this growing population needed huge amount of cheap wines for the proper consumption. Yeah, and never forget in those days, just to give you two numbers, in those days the average consumption of wine per capita was at 70 liters. Yeah, nowadays we're at 18. Yeah, so really people drank much more wine.
I remember when I was growing up in Uruguay, there was no such thing as sitting down to lunch without a bottle of vino. I mean, that was totally uncivilized.
Of course, in Spain was exactly the same. So when the population demanded those huge volumes, this was, let's say, the key moment for the wine negociants, for the wine buyers. And they went up to the mountain, and from those remaining mountain farmers, all the narrow-minded, and they tried to take advantage of them and to buy the stuff for very little money. And finally, to have more power against those negociants, in 1933, five families decided to join, to build up a corporation. So it's a cooperative. It's somehow like a kibbutz a little bit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, 2 years later there was the civil war in Spain. Yeah, never forget that Spain itself was never involved in the second war, because at the same time with Franco they had their own civil war. So even in our Capçanes, you know, Capçanes is the name of the village,
the village.
Yeah,
the village.
And in the village itself we are only 400 inhabitants. And even in this small village we had both parties of the civil war, and even people killed each other. Yeah, so this so on one side there was the idea of cooperation. On the other side, there was the idea of civil war. So two concepts really didn't work out.
Right.
Which means the real start of the cooperation was in the 1670s, when all the bad memories of the civil war had been forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
People started to talk again to each other. They started to join the cooperation. And so in the 70s and the 80s, what we did was only bulk wine. Yeah, tank wine. Which means we never, ever bottled anything until, the 90s. In 1975, Franco died. In 1978, Spain got democracy. Yeah, it's only 30 years ago. It was yesterday. Yeah. So, and when Spain got its democracy in 82, when they got into the European Union, Spain opened himself to Northern Europe, and also got lots of new technology and new ideas in winemaking. And they introduced, for example, stainless steel tanks, temperature-controlled fermentation, et cetera. And at that moment, when some of the big guys in Spain started to have these new facilities, and guys who used to buy until these days only bulk wine from us, they decided to switch to take only grapes and to vinify the grapes in their own facilities under much better conditions. So the mid-80s, beginning of the 90s, the worst happened to us, what can happen to wineries, which means from a bulk wine producer, which is already pretty bad, we became declassified to become a simple grape supplier, yeah, which is worse what can happen to a winery. And in the beginning of the 90s, our area, which is called Monsanto, yeah, nobody really expected that the Monsanto area, within such a short period, would become so famous. Yeah, and so in the beginning of the 90s, when people noticed that something is going on in this area, all those big guys, those big global players who used to buy bulk wines from us and who used to buy grapes from us, suddenly they started to buy land. And of course we became very nervous, because our one and only customer we had, suddenly he became a big landowner in the Monsanto area, and it was just a question of time that he wouldn't need us anymore as a grape supplier. And then in 1995, desperately, we looked for some alternative market, and the strangest idea we have had was listening to demands of the Jewish community in Barcelona to do a kosher wine, because in 1995 there was no kosher wine made for 100 years, and they told us, if you do kosher, there will be a big market all over the world. You're going to sell 100,000 bottles. Blah, blah, blah. What never happened. Okay? But we did
not yet.
Not yet, but okay, we're doing it already for 17 years, so I think it's time. No, but finally, what happened is the first vintage was 95, and the second vintage, the 96 vintage, by José Penin. José Penin, he's like Robert Parker in Spain. He's the most influential wine writer in Spain. He reviewed this wine after Pingus and Lemaître to be the third best wine. And Pingus Lemaître is $800 a bottle, $600 a bottle, and then the third was our Peraja Biflor de Primavera. And of course, this was just when I finished my studies, when I started to live in Spain. I worked for a couple of importers, tasted this wine. I've never had a kosher wine in my life, but I was curious to know, to learn about
what
kosher.
Is it?
What is it? Tasted. I fall in love with it immediately because it was amazing. And based on this kosher wine, for the two companies I used to work, we built up a non-kosher wine range. So the reference of our non-kosher wines was the first kosher wine we did. So the story of Capsanas is really, it's so bizarre. A bulk wine producer became a grape producer, then a kosher wine producer, and finally a non-kosher wine producer. There are no Jews in the village. There's no Jewish investment in the company. So the Catholic, narrow-minded mountain farmers invested their own money in the Jewish religion to become independent from those bulk wine sales. And then, if you want to top it even, a German winemaker comes by, tastes the kosher wine, falls in love with it, and builds up the non-kosher range. So it's really so strange.
As you said, it's a completely bizarre story. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Where is the company going next in the kosher line? Are there any new introductions already or coming? Or
Yeah. I think what happened, nowadays we do three kosher wines. Yeah. But everything started with Flor de Primavera, Peraja Habibi. But the funny thing about the wine is, if you notice, Peraja Habibi should be the translation of Flor de Primavera, which means spring flower. But the first rabbi we've had, he was from Northern Africa, and his Hebrew wasn't good enough. And he mixed up Hebrew with Arab. Because Habib in Arab, Habibi, means my dear, my lover.
Right.
And it should be Habib.
Right.
So that's just to make it even more funny story. So, but this mistake was done by the rabbi himself. So it's really it's a very nice
it's
way.
Okay.
It's
we
a
still
very
understand
nice.
It, and it works either way.
Okay.
Whether it's the flower of my lover or the flower of spring, it's still beautiful name.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So everything started with this wine. But 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, in the kosher wine world, most people were still used to the pasteurized, semi-sweet, more traditional style of kosher wines. And it was very difficult for us to move somebody who comes from that kind of that style of wine suddenly to this very serious. Yeah. And so in 2004, 2005, we decided to do a baby, which we called Peraja Petita. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The small flower, Peraja Petita. And then 2 years ago, that the top wine of our non-kosher range, it's Cabrida. And Cabrida, it's really unique because it's pure Grenache, pure Garnacha, from 105 years old bush wines. And this wine in 2007, and now with 2010, it's the second vintage, we did 7 barrels kosher. Okay, so La Flor del Flor is pure Garnacha from 105 years old bush wines.
Wow.
So very old vines, very low yield, but the fruit is amazingly concentrated, very complex.
Specifically because it's a low yield.
Exactly. There's lower the yield, much more intensity in flavors and taste you get into the wine. So this is very unique. And it's particularly very unique because Garnacha, it's what we call a feminine variety. It's a variety completely the opposite to those big blockbusters, Cabernets or Shiraz or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So Garnacha, it's more similar to Pinot Noir. So I think Flor de Flor is really highly appreciated by somebody who's already into wine. Yeah. because usually the movement is then when you start drinking wine.
You start with the sweet ones or semi-sweet.
You start with semi-sweet, sweet, then you move on to very big, I call them California Dream Boys.
Right.
Very big and masculine, you know.
Right.
And then later on, at a certain stage, you get bored by those
right.
big ones. And you want it more quiet, more introverted, more fragile, more tender.
Mm-hmm.
And so La Fleur de Flore is definitely one of those very delicate, very elegant wines.
In general, my experience with Spanish wines, I find them very unusual, especially some of the specifically Spanish grapes like Panza Blanca or Tempranillo.
Mm.
Yes, there are others who have used Tempranillo, but not with the same success as Spain. I guess it doesn't grow as well except within the specific areas in Spain, the specific terroir.
In our era, we don't do Tempranillo at all. We have very little, because Tempranillo comes from the Spanish word temprano, which means it's an early ripening variety. And we are in the southern part of Barcelona, so we are on the Mediterranean coast.
Mm-hmm.
And our area is simply, climate-wise, weather-wise, it's simply too positive, it's too good. Yeah. So early ripening varieties in too good conditions, they get ripe too soon, so you get the sugar,
right.
but you don't get the complexity. So Tempranillo, if Tempranillo has to be good, you have to go to the cool climate areas of Spain.
Right.
In any other places, Tempranillo is quite boring.
Absolutely.
So you have to be careful. Yeah, Tempranillo
uh-huh.
can be very good, but only in specific areas.
Specific areas. In fact, what I was trying to say is that in general, just about every Spanish wine I have tasted has been outstanding.
Mm.
Whether it was Peraja Habib or some of the competition, fantastic wines.
Mm.
Even when they mix it with some of the more traditional grapes like a Cabernet or a Merlot, still the results are distinctively Spanish. I don't think I have found that type of taste anywhere else.
Yeah. I think in sometimes, for example, in Peraja Habib, it happens quite in a strong way. I think it's a very nice compromise between old world. Yeah, and new world.
Absolutely.
Yeah? You get the richness of the new world, but you also get the backbone from the old world. But it's not, for example, here we have some Cabernet Sauvignon, but it's not like a Bordeaux Cab,
right.
which when it's young, it's undrinkable because it's so tannin. Yeah?
Yeah.
So I think you really have, it's for somebody...
It's very well balanced.
Yeah,
very
on
well
halfway
balanced.
Between the new and the old stuff.
Okay, thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure having you on our show, sir.
My pleasure.
And I guess you leave me no choice. I'm going to have to visit Spain. I'm going to have to visit Capçanes.
Hope to see you soon.
And our next guest is Philip Jones, owner and winemaker at both New Zealand's Goose Bay and at the brand new Oregon winery, Pacifica. Good evening, Philip.
Hi, how are you? I started in the wine business because I grew up in San Jose, California, back in the 60s. And when I grew up in San Jose, it was all orchards. It wasn't all electronic plants. And so I missed that. As all those orchards were converted to houses and electronic plants, I missed it. So I went to school, a city boy. I went to agricultural school down in San Luis Obispo. And I had my bachelor's degree in viticulture. And I went on and did graduate work in pest management, which is entomology and plant pathology and things like that. I had tried to get into Davis for winemaking, but didn't have the A+ I needed that year to get in there. So I did my graduate work in pest management. I then started an agricultural research company, but always enjoyed wine. My dad's French. I grew up with wines, which was kind of strange during the 50s and 60s. And most people didn't drink wine back then.
Not in the United States. In South America, where I grew up, you did not sit down to a meal without wine.
Exactly. And my dad never sat down to a meal without wine. So I learned to like wine from an early age. I married and had this ag research business in the Central Valley of California. I lived in Fresno, so I went back to school when I was in my early 40s, and I took all of the winemaking courses and got my further degree in winemaking. Well, at that time, California was getting a bit crowded, and I didn't like it anymore. I traveled to New Zealand. I rather liked New Zealand. Not too many people down there, and it takes a while to get there, so not a lot of people go there. So I moved to New Zealand, and we had some young children at the time, and it was a great place to raise kids. I needed something to do, and of course, what came along, well, I was trained in viticulture, so I planted vineyards. It was at the beginning of the wine industry in New Zealand. It was an exciting time, and I was the only American winemaker down there, and we started making wines in Nelson on the top of the South Island, and we did very well. We made a reputation for ourselves, especially for our Chardonnays. They said, it's a California Chardonnay. And they called me the California winemaker. Well, we move along about 10 years, and I'd remembered about kosher wines. And I knew nobody in New Zealand was making them. So I investigated them, found out what we needed to do. And on a trip to London one year, I stopped in New York and saw Nathan at Royal Wines. And he said, Phil, he says, we've been thinking about New Zealand. So there you go. The whole thing started from there, and it was great. We were not Jewish, and sometimes that might be easier, because once you learn how to make kosher wines and the kosher rules, and you have the supervision, which we get from Melbourne, where that's the closest group of observant Jews. There's not very many in New Zealand. Once you learn the rules, it's real simple. You just follow the rules. You don't have to question them. So we went along, and we've been making Goose Bay now for about 7 or 8 years. They're pretty well accepted, especially the Sauvignon Blanc, because it's very typical New Zealand. And the Pinot Noir, which, again, New Zealand is known for Pinot Noir. It's its second best known wine. We also make Chardonnay, we make Viognier, we make Pinot Gris. New Zealand's not as well known for those wines, but we make very, very good Chardonnay and Viognier as well, and Pinot Gris.
Are they kosher, all of them?
All of them are kosher, and all are Mavushal.
Wow.
Okay. Now.
So you mean that the wines that we tasted last night at the City Winery were actually Mavushal?
They were Mavushal. The Goose Bay ones were.
Superb wines. I never would have believed it was Mavushal if you hadn't told me.
I think there's a lot of controversy about Mavushal wines, and we don't have time to get into that today. But people have a lot of misconceptions about what flash pasteurizing does. And I'll just briefly, with white wines, it can really improve them. And a lot of non-kosher wineries, or some non-kosher wineries, actually use the process to release the aromatics. On red wines, it does age the wine. But sometimes that can be good. So we can talk about that some other time. How did I get to Oregon and Washington? Well, we'd lived in New Zealand for about almost 20 years. And my wife is from Minneapolis. We didn't want to go back to California. So we looked at Oregon as being a great place to go. I remember some fond visits up in Oregon and the Hood River Valley. And so we bought some property along the Columbia River, just across from the Hood River, at 1,800 feet, and we planted some vineyards there. And this was about 2005. And then the financial crash came along, and I was just going to open a boutique winery, non-kosher. I didn't want to get involved in kosher there. It's a lot of work. Then the financial crash comes along, and I said, I'm not opening a winery. This is crazy to be opening a winery along with the other 700 in Washington and compete with them. And I didn't do anything for a while. About a year later, Nathan comes along. He says, I hear you have a vineyard up in Washington. I said, yeah. He says, how about making us some Oregon Pinot, kosher, and some Washington wine? I said, I'm not really interested, Nathan. He persisted. And I finally saw the wisdom of it. Now, if you're going to have a winery in difficult times, and you don't want to compete with 700 other wineries in the Northwest, well, what do? Well, you make it a completely kosher winery.
That's what we've done.
Just
knocked out all the competition.
Boom, no competition. And we never wanted to be big there, so we have a small winery there, and we make about we made about 4,000 cases our first year. I don't think we'll probably go beyond 5,000 or 6,000 even if we're fortunate to have the consumers buy it. So it'll be a limited production winery. To give you an idea of size, in New Zealand we do the equivalent of about 75,000 cases, about 8,000 kosher. So it's a pretty good operation in New Zealand, a very tiny operation in Oregon. So it's a lot of fun. We've brought out the Oregon, the Pacifica Pinot Noir, the Meritage, which is from Walla Walla. The Oregon is from the Willamette Valley, the Pinot from Willamette Valley, and a little bit from the Hood River Valley. We're bringing out a Cabernet in about 6 months, which is from Walla Walla, again from two really great vineyards, Pepperbridge and Seven Hills Vineyards, which some of the best wineries in Washington buy grapes from them. We're lucky to get grapes from them. We're bringing out a Cab, and these are non-Nevushel, by the way. And why did I not use flash pasteurization? Because it's the first time we made the wine. You need to understand your wines before you start doing things like that. Next year, though, I've already made a wine, in 2011, a Cab Merlot from the Yakima area, Red Mountain area, which will be Mevushel. So we'll take care of our customers that need Mevushel wines with a Cab Merlot that will be released next year. We're not going to probably, that will probably be the amount of wines we make up there. We will not make white wines. We could, but quite frankly, I think the New Zealand whites are better than we can make up in Washington and Oregon, so I'm not going to do it.
Right.
Yeah. And we can't make really good, other than Pinot, we can't make really great big red wines down in New Zealand. It's too cool. So it's a nice compromise. I get to make some of my red wines here in North America, and I make my good white wines down there, and I make Pinot in both places.
Good. Thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure having you here. Just like it was a pleasure listening to you last evening at the City Winery. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you very much.
And our next guest is Jeff Morgan from the Covenant Winery in Napa Valley. Good evening, Jeff.
Good evening, Chaim.
Tell us a little bit about Covenant, and specifically, what did you set out to do differently? Let's face it, Napa Valley is full of wineries. What's different about Covenant?
Well, that's a very good question. We're different because we're kosher. Of all of those wineries in Napa Valley, there are only two of us that make kosher wine. So that is a point of differentiation right there.
I've tasted the Covenant wines, so I've not tasted the other one, and I find them amazing.
Well, thank you very much. Basically, what happened was back in 2003, we were tasting, there are a lot of Jewish winemakers in Napa, but most of us don't make kosher wine. And so we have an organization that gets together now, and then we had a big Jewish winemaker tasting of all our wines. And at the time, I wasn't making Covenant. I was making a non-kosher wine called Solo Rosa. And my partner in Covenant, a guy named Leslie Rudd, who also owns Dean and DeLuca, the famous food chain, he has his own winery called Rudd Winery. And we had the tasting at Rudd. And while we were there, we invited Eli Ben Zekan from Castel to join us because we knew he was in town with his wine. And so he brought some of his wines, and it was I think it was possibly the only kosher wine there that day. And we tasted the Castel, and we thought, wow, this is really good. And Leslie said to me, well, how come there aren't more really good kosher wines like Castel out there? And I said, well, you know, there are more than you would think, but we could make one really good from Napa Valley if you just let me use some of your grapes from your, because he has very, very fine vineyards. And so we started to, Leslie actually wouldn't let me use his grapes. He was afraid. He said, what if you mess it up, Jeff? It's going to be the worst kosher wine in 5,000 years from my vineyard. And I said, well, Les, what do you want to do? And he said, you find another vineyard, and I'll be your partner and back you on this project. So I went and found a small parcel of another vineyard called the Larkmead Vineyard up in northern Napa, and they agreed to sell me their grapes. And now there was only one thing missing. I needed a Shomer Shabbat cellar crew because I am Jewish, but I'm not Shomer Shabbat, and neither is Leslie. And there is no Shomer Shabbat crew in Napa.
In Napa.
So, at least not full time. So I called my friends, the Herzogs, who I knew for many years. And I called Nathan Herzog, and I said, Nathan, I have this idea. Can I borrow your crew down at your winery down in Southern California? And he thought about it, and he said, okay, if you let us distribute your wines. So he brought our wines down to Oxnard. Actually, in those days it was in Santa Maria, but close to Oxnard. And we made our first vintage of Cabernet. And I stayed with in the Herzog's winery till 2007. And in 2008, I managed to find one Mashgiach winemaker who lived in the Bay Area who could help me. So we started making the wine closer to where our grapes are from. And finally, Leslie, in 2008, let me also use some of his grapes as well. And so since 2008, we've been making Covenant in the Napa Valley. Now, what's different about us in general from the kosher scene? Well, Napa Valley fruit, that's the big difference, I think. We don't do anything particularly special. We use native yeast. We don't inoculate our wine with any yeast. We use native ML, malolactic, in general. We don't filter our wines. We don't typically fine them either. So it's a very natural process. Mm-hmm. But I think the big difference is that our wines are very evocative of the vineyards that we get our grapes from. And so hopefully they're a true expression of the terroir that we find in the Russian River Valley with our Lavan Chardonnay, or Napa Valley with Covenant Cabernet Sauvignon. The Red Sea, our second label, is the press wine from Covenant and free run from another small vineyard. We don't use any new oak in the Red Sea. It's the once-used oak barrels from Covenant, so it's a little different. But that's about it. We're just trying to make the best wine we can and keep it kosher.
I understand that you were a writer. How did you get to become a winemaker?
Actually, I started as a winemaker, and then I became a writer. So what happened was I lived in France. I was a saxophone player, actually, is what happened. I was a saxophone player in France for many years. And one day I just decided, I was the band leader at the Grand Casino in Monte Carlo. And my boss was Prince Rainier, and I had big hair and shiny suits, the dancing girls, and I was very unhappy. And I thought, God, this is just getting really old. But I love wine as much as I love music. Maybe I'll become a winemaker. So I came back to New York, where I'm from originally, and got a job in a little winery in Long Island as a cellar guy, where they would hire somebody like me who knew nothing and train me. And I worked there for a couple of years, and decided that they weren't paying me enough. I needed to go back to being a musician. So I quit the winery, went back to being a full-time musician. This was in 1991. And I started writing just for the local newspaper. We stayed out in the wine country in Long Island. And then somehow I worked my way into the New York Times. It must have been dumb luck. And
I'm sure it was not luck. Professionalism.
And then I did a story about Long Island wines, and somebody from the Wine Spectator saw that article and saw my name and my byline and called me and said, Jeff Morgan, we know the wines that you were making in Long Island, and we know you, but we didn't know you were a writer. And I said, well, no, I'm writing. And they said, well, we have a story for you at the Wine Spectator. And this was in 1992, January of 1992. And I said, me? The Wine Spectator. All right, what's the story? And they said, we want you to write the kosher wine for Passover story. And I said, is this Beshert or what? I said, you're kidding me. I don't know anything about kosher wine. I don't know anything about kosher. In fact, they said, but you're Jewish, right? And I said, yeah, I'm Jewish, but I wasn't even bar mitzvah. I mean, I grew up totally assimilated. And they said, well, take it or leave it. You know, you want to write for the Wine Spectator, you got to do this story. So I said, okay, I'll take it. So I called the Herzog family right away. I got a hold of Jay Buxbaum. Who else? And Jay fed me whatever it is he wanted me to say that day. And I went to, drove into the city, ate in a couple of good kosher restaurants like Tevere and Levana.
Ah, yes.
And where they were pouring non-Mavushal wine in those days.
Right.
And we, I learned, I found some good wines. In fact, I found the Herzog wines are really good. And so the Spectator liked what I did, and for 7 years I wrote for them. And every year I had to write that story about kosher wine. And every year I would find more good kosher wine. So I knew that you could make good wine that was kosher. There's no difference, really, except about who touches it, really. I mean, you don't have to make a Mavushal, and even Mavushal, I mean, it's not like Mavushal used to be. You know, flash pasteurization is minimal. We don't do Mavushal because I figure I'm going to the trouble to make the best wine I can, and I don't need to flash pasteurize. We don't. It's not that important to our market, so we're not doing it. But whatever. So so I knew the kosher world. I knew Peter Stern. I knew what was going on with the Herzog. So that's why I. When we hatched this idea, that's how I could call Nathan Herzog and say, Nathan, I have this idea. I already knew him, and I knew what the scene was. And by the way, I got bar mitzvah 5 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And my daughter is in Israel right now, which is great. And I have another one who's going to the University of Haifa next year. So all of this wine stuff, is wine is really powerful. In case you didn't know it, there's a reason we make Kiddush over wine. It's because it is holy. And connects us to God.
Well, obviously, in the case of wine, it brought you back to Judaism.
It did. It did. And, you know, I'm not wearing a kippah today, but I do put on my tefillin every morning.
Very nice.
And, you know, we don't have a minyan in Napa, but we got a Chabad rabbi, and so we're pretty close. And we make a little wine with him, too. And we call it Kuvei Chabad.
Very nice, very nice.
Yeah.
That was a very, very touching story, how through wine, you came back to your roots.
Yeah.
All because the Wine Spectator wanted you to write a story that you supposedly knew nothing about.
I think Hashem wanted me to write that story. No, it was definitely an act of God.
So, what year did you start making the Covenant wine?
2003.
That's when you first put it on the market.
Yeah. Well, we put it on the market in 2005, probably, but mm-hmm. The first vintage was 2003.
2003.
Yeah. So we've been at it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 9 years.
What are some of the wine varieties that you make?
Our red wines are exclusively Cabernet. We make a Chardonnay that we started making in 2008. And now we also, last year for the first time, made a Sauvignon Blanc under the Red Sea label. And that's our second vintage this year. We're releasing right before Pesach. So Sauvignon Blanc and Cabernet for the Red
mm-hmm.
Sea,
right.
And Chardonnay and Cabernet for Covenant.
Very good. And what's the price range of this one?
The Levan is $38 approximately. That's our suggested California
mm-hmm.
retail. Suggested California retail for Covenant is $90. And the Red Sea suggested California retail is $44 for the Cabernet, and the Sauvignon Blanc will be $24.
Now, since we are close to Purim and a month later is Passover, somebody comes to you and says, Jeff, I am sick of the sweet wines for the four choices, for the four cups. What do you recommend? I mean, the guy doesn't know much about dry wines and may not yet have started cultivating his palate. Do you have a wine that you would recommend for such a person?
Well, I don't think it says anywhere that the wine has to be red for the four cups, correct? Does it have to be red? Are you sure?
I'm almost positive.
If we have a loophole, okay, because we like, well, what we've done, just for, not for this, not for your gentleman, but we've actually had a different vintage of every Covenant. One different vintage for every cup. That's kind of fun. But since we start Pesach, you know, with gefilte fish and all this stuff that doesn't really, in my opinion, go so well with the whites, with reds, mm-hmm. we like to start with white wine. and then work our way into the reds. So that said, $44 for red wine is probably going to be a little steep for this guy. So if it is, I would suggest he look for a varietal that offers better value, like Zinfandel, maybe Syrah. I know the Herzogs make a really good Zinfandel.
Does Cabernet make anything like it?
We this our least expensive red is our Cabernet, so our Red Sea Cabernet at $44. Mm-hmm. So if you want to splurge, I mean, for example, it is Pesach, and it's a pretty important holiday.
Yeah,
so
it comes once a year.
Yeah, depending on how many guests you have and how much money you have, I think the Red Sea would be perfect. Besides, there all is also a biblical theme.
Absolutely.
You know, the Red Sea, you get it. It's some people don't get that, okay, but. So yeah, so this is kind of a no-brainer, I would say, for Pesach. We're pouring the Red Sea.
That's right.
Very good. Thank you very, very much.
Well, Chaim, thank you for having me.
It was a very interesting conversation. You're also very entertaining, and I thank you for being on our show.
Thank you.
And our next guest, whom I will be interviewing together with Gila Hackerman, the author of Kosher Revolution. Our next guest is Morty Herzog, 8th generation winemaker. He is vice president and spokesman for the Royal Wine Corporation. Good evening, Morty.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
So, 8th generation winemaker, how did that happen? Where did it happen? Where in Europe? I assume it must have been in Europe.
That's correct. In Czechoslovakia, in the early 1800s, my great-great-grandparents, that is, started making wines in a city called Verbau. It's in today what is in the Slovakia region. In pre-war, it was part of Czechoslovakia. They started making wines. They were making great wines, so much so that the Austrian court chose and selected the Herzog wines for their personal uses, and that's when my grandparents, that is, became barons. When you were provided to the royal court, that earned you a title of honor, and they were ordained as barons. Some of our wines today are still called Baron Herzog. That's to commemorate that period of time. And the wine business stayed with us until World War II, where my grandfather, Eugene Herzog, was making wines in Verbau along with his three brothers. Obviously, the war disrupted all that, and my grandparents were fortunate enough to have gone into hiding before the war started, along with my uncles. My dad was actually born a couple of weeks after the war, so my grandparents were in hiding. As soon as the war was over, there were some righteous people that protected the winery and kept the winery going. And when the war was over and my grandfather came out of hiding, he went back and claimed the winery, and he started all over again with some minor success. But then the communist regime took over Czechoslovakia, and what the Nazis didn't accomplish from a financial standpoint, the communists did. And my grandfather ran with whatever he had in his pocket, which wasn't much. He left Czechoslovakia, came to the United States in 1948, and more or less virtually penniless. Whatever money he had, he spent on the trip. He wanted to fly, go by air. He was so afraid of what's going to happen, of the consequences of staying there, that he just found the fastest way out. We actually still have the manifest from that Pan Am flight, where my grandfather and his children, my grandmother and his children, came to the United States, started all over again. Initially, my grandfather had a job. He got a job as a winemaker for a new, young startup. They couldn't afford to pay him because the winery wasn't doing all that well, and they gave him shares. Those shares weren't worth much, and in about 1952, 53, my grandfather was ready to throw in the towel and give up on this venture. But then he went to some rabbis for advice. He had a dream. It's a long story, but I won't get into that. And to make a long story short, his decision was made to stay in the wine business and stick it out. And from there, thank God, God has been good to us and smiled upon us, and we were more successful. My father joined the company in the early 70s, and his vision was to make quality wines, kosher wines that are truly quality wines, not just wines that are kosher, but quality wines that just happen to be kosher. So in mid-1970s, we started importing wines from France, and people would challenge my dad and tell him, why are you importing dry wines? Nobody in the kosher market appreciates it. There is no customer for that. And my father, being the visionary he is, felt that, well, if there are no customers now, we'll educate them, and one day there will be. And when you see an event like tonight, that's a great testimony to how far the kosher market has come.
I have a couple of questions, Gila. When your father first started producing wine, where was he producing it, or was it import to begin with?
Well, they started producing wines in New York under the Ketem label. Ketem is still our brand. We make grape juice and wine under the Ketem label. But when he started making more quality wines, he went and searched for different pastures. So he would go to France, and he started importing a wine from France, a Bordeaux. Then he went to Italy, and in mid-1980s, he went to California, and that was the founding of the Herzog Winery.
Yes, that was my next question, how the Renaissance in California wine affected your company.
So as the interest in kosher wines grew modestly and slowly, but it progressed, my dad felt we should have a domestic wine. Obviously, in the United States, California is a very significant wine region. So he set out and he met a gentleman named Peter Stern. Now that sounds like a Jewish name, but Peter actually isn't Jewish. And
just
he
Stern.
Just Stern, exactly. So Peter joined my dad. He bought into his vision. Peter is a fantastic winemaker, and he was vital in founding the Baron Herzog Winery in 1985.
Well, I have to tell you, one of my favorites of all time is your Reserve Cabernet.
Yeah, you know, the Reserve, that's absolutely true. The Reserve Cabernet, when people ask me, I want to step up a little bit, and you don't want to have wines that one vintage is great, you know, what's hot today but maybe not tomorrow, the Herzogs are probably the most consistent high-quality wines, so you're absolutely right.
And they keep beautiful, they age beautifully.
They age beautifully. It's funny you mentioned that. This Shabbos, I actually had a bottle of 2000 Napa Valley Cabernet. The cork had a like inky purple. I mean, you put your finger on it, it looked like you voted in the Iraqi election. So you have that purple finger. And the wine was just beautiful. I have to think of it as an 11-year-old wine and had years to go. So that's right.
Yes, no, I've had a lot of luck with that because I always stock up the Pesach and then drink it all year long.
Yes.
When I first came to the United States in 1962, the choice of wines, whether it was Ketem, whether it was Shapiro or the other small wineries, was extra sweet and even sweeter. How did you manage to educate the palate of the average Fimer Yid that he should accept that there is such a thing other than just extra sweet wine?
So, to be honest with you, it's a work in progress. I don't think we have arrived, but we're definitely en route. We started the process in the mid-1970s. Obviously, the kosher market has evolved. I mean, people are more interested in food, as your radio show, I'm sure, speaks to. People are more interested in food. People travel. People are more multicultural. The kosher market is less isolated than it was. So the typical kosher consumer travels the world, mingles. And as the level of interest from the kosher consumer grew, our quality grew with it. We'd like to believe that we truly educated a new consumer, somebody who has not been interested in kosher wine, but that level of interest is growing, and we're still not fully there. We still sell plenty of sweet kosher wine. Manischewitz still sells plenty of sweet kosher wine, but I'd like to believe that the younger generation is definitely more and more into wines. And look, wine is art, wine is culture. And as people become more cultural, people eat out more, people travel more, their level of interest in wine usually evolves along with that.
So just to go further with that question, there is a much larger interest in kosher food in general. The kosher market is burgeoning. Do you find that you have a non-Jewish or non-kosher customer as well who also looks towards kosher as being healthier and better in some way?
Really, yes and no, because on one side, there are still people who are riddled in the past of kosher wine being sweet and everything. It's not, and it hasn't been the sweet, syrupy wines for over 20 years now. But people, you know, it's hard to break a myth. Myths tend to be very persistent.
Yes.
And we're still challenged with that myth. But I can tell you with time, with the level of quality, the only answer to that myth is produce quality wines, people will eventually get the message. They once said the simplest lesson in business is make a good product and let the world know you have it. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make a quality product, and we're trying to let the world know that we do that. So shows like this, that is exactly what we're trying to accomplish tonight.
I see you've expanded your repertoire of sparkling wines. You have the Moscatos now. Are you also going to be branching out into Champagnes or Proseccos?
We have a Prosecco from Bartonura. It's relatively new, about 3-4 years old, doing extremely well. Proseccos are hot. We have some wonderful Cavas from Spain under the LV label Adar. They're absolutely wonderful. Bartonura, perfect Purim wine, that's true. Now, Bartonura is a story in itself because Bartonura has enjoyed tremendous growth and recognition, and we just introduced for the first time a sparkling Moscato in a blue bottle. We introduced it the day after the Super Bowl, very appropriate for the big,
for the
other big blue, that's right. So we introduced it the day after the Super Bowl. The introduction has gone great. The reception is fantastic, and we think it'll be a very successful product.
I just want you to know that when I have my Rosh Hashanah dinners, when I have a toast, I always put a few pomegranate seeds in the bottom of a bottle with your Prosecco.
That's great.
Everybody
loves it. Now, Gila, you asked a question about whether they have a champagne, and they do have Drapier, which you've seen in my blog.
Yes.
It happens to be a superb champagne. I cannot tell you how it compares with other champagnes, but it certainly hits the spot when I think of what a champagne should be.
Well, yes, Drapier is not a kosher champagne. Drapier is a well-known champagne out of France.
Right.
And when you say how it compares to non-kosher champagnes, well, it obviously stands up because Drapier is doing extremely well in the world of champagnes. We also have the Laurent Perrier, which is probably one of the five most well-known champagnes and definitely one of the most respected champagnes out there. So we have the Laurent Perrier, we have the Drapier, and when French champagnes of well-known champagnes that have been around for hundreds of years are producing kosher blends, that tells you something about what they see and where they see the world of kosher is going.
Well, when we had Pierre Miodovnik here a few minutes ago, as he pointed out, some of the most famous French chateaus like Pontet-Canet and a few others, and Piada and Chateau Guiraud, are producing kosher versions of their wines. Obviously, they appreciate the market. They understand that that's where it's going. And I dare say that it's probably no less quality than the regular fare.
That's a fair statement. I think that these brands protect their reputation and integrity, and if they didn't feel that it was up to par and up to standards with what their brand stands for, they probably wouldn't allow us to market it under their brand. So, yes, that's probably a true statement.
Now, the kosher market, as we have been saying, has undergone tremendous change. Where do you see it going from here? And how far does it still have to come to be on par with the non-kosher market?
Well, in terms of consumption, there really isn't great data, but our sense is that we are by far lower in consumption than the average American consumer, and we know that the American consumer is well behind the French and most European consumers in terms of consumption. What you really need to do is go to a high-end kosher restaurant where people are spending $70 a plate, and maybe one in six tables have a bottle of wine. Now, in the non-kosher world, you would probably see five tables with wine and maybe one without wine. So I think we have a way to go in terms of consumption, but we're patient, and we see it progressing. And the main thing is the trend is heading in the right direction. People are definitely consuming more wine, and it's happening gradually, and I think it's something that's going to continue, I hope, with God's help. That it's something that's going to continue for many years to come.
And I understand we're also starting to see Israeli and French kosher wines in non-kosher restaurants, and that they are quite well regarded in such establishments.
That's absolutely right. People are starting to come around. People are starting to realize, as I said before, if you make a quality product and you stick to it and you do it well, people will eventually notice. And that's what's happening. The Israelis are making fantastic wines. Herzog is making fantastic wines. And despite the image of kosher wines, which is ancient, and like I said, is over 20 years old now, or more like 30 years old now, people are recognizing the wines for what they are. I often tell people, and if you see the room now, it's full of, you know, people that don't keep kosher, and they're tasting the wine based on the merit of the wine, based on the quality of the wine, not based on its kosher status. And that is something that is happening as people are becoming more open-minded. People are becoming less pretentious and presumptuous, where they presume something is, and therefore when they taste it, they don't allow it to give it a fair chance. But when people taste kosher wine or any wine with an open mind, they realize that kosher wine has no bearing on the quality. There are great kosher wines, and there are terrible kosher wines. But that's true about Australian wines, French wines, and I dare to say any wine around the world. There are going to be great wines and less great wines, and that's true about kosher. But there are definitely some kosher wines that rival any non-kosher wines and receive ratings accordingly.
Well, as a matter of fact, talking on ratings, for example, LV wines, some of the wines are considered among the greatest Spanish wines. In fact, the Guía Peñin, which is the greatest authority on Spanish wines, the Spanish version of Robert Parker, out of 180 top Spanish wines, out of 9,000 produced, he has just chosen 7 from LV Wines, more than from any other winery, including wineries that make a greater variety, a greater selection. So yes, it's proof enough that kosher does not have any impact on the quality. It's quality or it's not.
I just want to make a comment. I think that there's been a real renaissance in kosher food altogether. If you see what type of restaurants are available and the caliber of kosher food that's available these days, and do you think that that's influenced your business, that people are now looking for the appropriate wine to have with that level of food?
You know, it's one feeds the other. I'm not sure which one comes first, but it's definitely more of an indication of a consumer. So it's a trend. I think that food definitely helps wine. I think wine helps food. If you look at the event tonight, it's KFWE. There was a lot of thought that went into that name. Although we're in the wine business primarily, we're in the food business too, but we're in the restaurant business, but not in New York. We definitely called the wine, the show, Kosher Food and Wine Experience, with the F definitely taking an important part in the show, and why we dedicate half the room to restaurants, because we do recognize that these cultures are definitely complementary of one another. And with the rise of interest in food, the rise of interest in wine definitely goes with it.
Yeah.
So where is the Royal Wine Corporation going from here? What new landmarks do you want to reach?
Well, we're working on many fronts. Like I said, Bartonura is now the number one selling imported Moscato in the United States, regardless of its kosher status. Moscato is a great category to be in. It's a category that's up close to 90% in 2011, and all the predictions are, all the indicators are, that it will continue to rise. So we're playing very aggressively in the Bartonura Moscato category. And in terms of making a quality wine, I don't believe in setting a mission that is not attainable. Our mission is to continue growing at a steady pace. Like I said, we still have a way to go in terms of getting the kosher consumer up in consumption to where the general market consumer is. So our mission, really, we want to stick to making superb wines. And again, what's as important as making good wines is making wines that are good value, wines that you can buy at $10. We have not ignored the $10 price points. We have literally hundreds of wines at $10, $15 price points, and we constantly introduce new wines, because I do believe that if you're just going to make a quality wine, you're going to start at $30, that's a prohibitive entry level. So we like for people to enter, try $10 wines like the Baron Herzogs are under $15, the Barkan Classics are under $15, Binyamina just introduced a wine at under $15, the Bin. So we're going to keep on developing this, in our mind, young, fresh, innovative market where there's a lot of room for growth. We're going to do that by, like I said, making quality wines for a good price.
With Pesach almost upon us, what would you recommend for the average guy? Doesn't know that much about wine, but he does know that he's sick already of all those extra sweet wines for the arbacoises. In fact, he gets sick from all the sugar. What would you recommend in a way that would also educate his palate?
So we have actually introduced a bunch of wines that we call educational wines, because to get a consumer from Kedem Crema Lager to even Baron Herzog Cabernet, which is a young, fruity Cabernet, is challenging. It's not an easy step. So what we try to do is we introduced a bunch of wines on the semi-dry category, and thank God they have been very, very well received. The number one wine in that category is Jeunesse. It's right in the middle. So if Crema Lager or Malaga or Concord is a 10, Cabernet is a 0, this is 5 in terms of sweetness. We have, in whites, we have a Chenin Blanc that's superb. It's a semi-dry, it's a semi-dry wine, again, something that a non-dry wine consumer can appreciate as well. Jeunesse is definitely a good place to start. We have Rashi Claret, which is in that category. We have Zmora, which is in the category of the semi-dries. We have Tzion has a wine that's in from Israel that's in the category of semi-dries. So we're constantly looking at that category because we feel that that's an important category. If we're going to be educating consumers to move towards dry wines, that's a category that we have to continue expanding on. But if you want to move up and you're ready to drink a dry wine, Baron Herzog Cabernet, in terms of consistent quality and value, as I mentioned before, Baron Herzog Cabernet, I think, and Merlot, in general, the Baron Herzog lines stand for value. Great QPR, quality price ratios, are really fantastic on the Baron Herzog line.
And talking about the high end of Baron Herzog, at one point you had Generation 8. Is that still being produced?
Generation 8 was produced last in 2006. It has not been produced again. It will be produced eventually, but we really need to find wines that are worthy of carrying that brand. It's a brand of super, super premium wines, and if our winemaker doesn't feel that he has wines that are up to snuff and that are worthwhile, he will not make it. So we have no qualms about missing 5 vintages, 6 vintages. It's not a wine that we're looking to build a brand. It's a quality wine that when we feel we've hit that perfect wine, that is when we're going to introduce the next generation 8. And being in the natural business, we're very dependent in God's graces. And making that wine is something that is a gift. It doesn't happen all the time. So we're looking out for it, but we don't know when it'll happen again.
Okay. Thank you very much, Morty. It was a pleasure. It was educational.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And this closes our broadcast for today, ladies and gentlemen. We will be back tomorrow evening, Thursday, with a second part of our Kosher Food and Wine Experience 2012. You will hear from Pierre Miodovnik, major kosher wine consultant to the French industry in general, and to Edmond de Rothschild specifically, as well as the owner of his own winery in Israel, Domaine Netofa, and consultant to the Royal Wine Corporation. Gila Hackerman and I will interview him. We'll also interview one of the people who attended the show, not as a winemaker, not as a restaurateur, but simply as somebody who just came to learn what's new, to enjoy what's there, Chef Jeff Ingber from Providence. We will also be talking live with Aaron Ritter, the president and founder of the Kosher Wine Society. Until then, thank you for listening, and good night to one and all.